The archive begins in 1940. The Germans themselves do not decide they're going to murder all the Jews. They don't decide on the final solution until late 1941. So when the archive begins, Ringelblum is creating the archive in order to do what Max Weinreich has been doing with the YIVO, that is to get people to write about their lives, to get people to describe their experiences so as to use the knowledge gained to help the psychological and the community rebuilding after the war. The war will be over. We'll rebuild our lives. What lessons will this experience have taught us? The way to get that information is to get people to write essays, to do interviews.
Welcome to the Psychoanalysis On and Off the Couch podcast. For the past few years, we've been speaking with analysts from around the world who've been applying their analytic way of thinking, not only to their offices, but also off the couch, in venues external to their consulting rooms. We've spoken to analysts who work in hospitals, in prisons, in community health centers, in refugee clinics, just to name a few. We've also detoured, of course, during COVID. We've spoken with analysts again from around the world to learn from our communities how they, their patients, and the analytic community in general have been dealing with this crisis. And hopefully the worst is over and we can return to our main focus. We can return to speaking to analysts who are bringing their skills to people who otherwise would never see the inside of an analyst's office. In addition to that, we're speaking with the elders of our field, people who have been practicing this craft for 40 and 50, sometimes longer years, to learn from them what they have to teach us, not only about this piece of history that we're all living through, but their reflections on our field. Please visit us at our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can leave a comment, where you can subscribe. I hope you find these conversations thoughtful and meaningful. And I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Professor Samuel Kassow. Professor Kassow is a historian, and the book of his that we discuss is entitled, Who Will Write Our History? And my suggestion is that this question about our personal histories is both a psychoanalytic question and as part of our enterprise, that is to help individuals discover their authentic history, to help them recognize that their sense of their history isn't identical to how they are seen by others, and how that same effort is what he describes in this book, referring to the Warsaw Ghetto. Because there was a remarkable effort by the inhabitants of the Warsaw Ghetto during the war to record their own history. And this was collected in an archive organized by Emanuel Ringelblum, who had contact with people who were influenced by analysts, contact with people who actually translated Freud, which played a part in the conceptualization of the way the archive was organized. I don't want to say much more than that because Professor Kassow describes it so powerfully and so beautifully. He is the Charles Northam Professor of History at Trinity College. He's written a great deal on Russian history and Jewish history. And this book of his was translated into eight languages and was also made into a movie produced by Nancy Spielberg and directed by Roberta Grossman. It is a movie worth watching. It's by the same name, Who Will Write Our History, though it is only a sliver of what one could learn by reading his book. He was part of the scholarly team that planned the Polish Museum of the History of the Polish Jews in Warsaw, which I have visited, which is a remarkable museum. And he's currently engaged in a project organized by Yad Vashem to write a history of the Holocaust in Poland. I found my conversation with him to be deeply moving and important. I hope you find it similarly. Here is my conversation with Professor Samuel Kassa. Sam, welcome to the podcast. I'm so glad to have you here. I recently traveled to Warsaw, and I was on a tour of the remains of the Warsaw Ghetto. And I learned something that startled me. I learned for the first time of the existence of an archive that consisted of meticulously kept contemporaneous documentation of the lived experience of the people who were herded into the Warsaw Ghetto and eventually murdered. And this documentation described everyday life. It was not written by or about the wealthy, the scholarly, the politically connected. It was everybody. The people who were starving, the people who were teaching children, the people who were trying to feed themselves on frozen potatoes. And what startled me about it was, even though I've since learned that this warranted inclusion in the UNESCO Memory of World Register, it was of that importance. And even though there's a movie about it named after your book, no one I spoke to here in the States, in Europe, Latin America as well, ever heard of it. It wasn't just I who had never heard of what's called the Ringelblum Archives. No one I knew, including historians and scholars, they never heard of it. And that took me aback. But more pressingly, for our purposes, the more I learned about the archive, the more it appeared to me to overlap with the psychoanalytic enterprise. And what I mean by that is, my understanding of one of the reasons for its being is that Ringelblum and the people who worked with him wanted to create a self-identity for the Jews in the ghetto that was apart from, distinct from, that which was being created about them by their murderers. The Germans characterized them as vermin, locked them in conditions with vermin, photographed them, and eventually killed them. And that was to be the story. It was the collective characterization of the Jewish people. And Ringelblum and his associates said no to that. They said, we will tell you who we are. We will share with you our individual voices, even the ugly aspects of our voices. We will be honest about who we are because we're people and we're our people and we'll define ourselves. And that struck me as, obviously writ large, very similar to what analysts do, in that we help patients learn who they are authentically. Who they are as distinct from who others see them to be, so that people can grow out of the false selves that they have assumed as children, and live a more authentic life. So that was a commonality that jumped out at me. But then there was one additional piece, and that is, and this is from your book, that the people who collected these snapshots of everyday life and brought them to Ringelblum, they would often say to him, well, this isn't important. This is trivial. Why would you want to include this? This doesn't make a point. It's probably similar to what I said yesterday. You probably think this is not worthwhile. And Emanuel Ringelblum said to them, nothing is unimportant. Nothing is unimportant. And we analysts, both as patients and now as analysts, know that very well. Patients come to us on a regular basis and say, of course my thoughts aren't important. Look how trivial this is. You don't want to hear this. You probably think I'm stupid. I said this yesterday. Why should I say it again? To which we say, Nothing is unimportant. Ringelblum said, trust the process. You bring in the snapshots of everyday life, and I'll collect them, and history will decide what our story is. And we say to our patients, trust the process, trust your mind in this work we're doing. And you bring in anything that comes to your mind and trust that it will lead somewhere worthwhile. And when I heard the nothing is unimportant, I said, you and I have to have a conversation. And here we are. But I want to make clear from the outset that this is not simply a Jewish story. Literal and cultural genocide is unfortunately not limited to any one ethnic group. Just take a snapshot of the world today, whether it be in Ukraine or the Uyghurs, and one can see it in many places. And Ringelblum stated this very clearly. And again, this was we have his memoirs because we have at least part of the archives. And let me read what he wrote. This is Emanuel Ringelblum writing. I do not see our work as a separate project, as something that includes only Jews, that is only about Jews, and that will interest only Jews. My whole being rebels against that. I cannot agree with such an approach as a Jew, as a socialist, or as a historian. Given the daunting complexity of social processes where everything is interdependent, it would make no sense to see ourselves in isolation. But it turns out that there is more of an overlap between the archives and psychoanalysis. It turns out that Emanuel Ringelblum had a mentor. His mentor was Max Weinreich. Max Weinreich had an analyst. His analyst was Siegfried Bernfeld, who later emigrated to San Francisco and helped start the institute there. But at this point in his life, he was a pioneer in applying psychoanalytic thinking to the understanding and treatment of adolescence. And he was also a pioneer in the understanding and thinking of applying psychoanalytic concepts to the community at large, what we now call off the couch. And Bernfeld and Weinreich collaborated. And in fact, Weinreich acknowledges him in the preface to one of his early books. And just as an aside, Weinreich also sought out Freud in an effort to understand how to help the Jewish population in Poland and in Warsaw during the 30s, because they were struggling terribly. And in fact, he translated Freud's introductory lectures into Yiddish. And this was an authorized translation by Freud, and Freud wrote him a note thanking him for it. But he was struggling how to help the Jews who were really second, third, and fourth class citizens in Warsaw and in Poland. And in fact, I've read that some Poles referred to the Jews there as the Warsaw Negroes. And when he had a chance, he received a Rockefeller grant to travel to the States. And Sam, let me turn this over to you because you have a deep knowledge of this journey of his, and share with us where he went and what he learned and with whom he spoke. And then let's pick up on this notion of life history, the history of everyday life, and how that was important both to Bernfeld and to Weinreich and to Ringelblum, and it formed a core conceptual basis of the archive.
Thanks for having me. Max Weinreich was a philologist. He was a linguist. He was interested in social psychology. He was interested in history. What he really dedicated himself to was how to get people that lacked a state, that lacked an army, that lacked power, a people that was discriminated against, a people whose language, Yiddish, was considered a second-rate dialect, how to get this group, East European Jewry, and the most vulnerable members of that group, adolescents growing up into a society that stigmatized them, i.e. the majority Polish society, how to use knowledge, self-knowledge, the knowledge of everyday life, how to use that in order to enable members of that group to defend themselves psychologically. When somebody tells you that you are less, when somebody tells you that you are not as good, when somebody tells you that you don't belong here, you should leave, what are the mechanisms that you could bring to bear to protect yourself, to protect your identity, to build up a sense of pride and self-worth? And Weinreich understood that the level of discourse, the level of knowledge, culture that defined Polish Jewry was a culture that was defined by political ideologies, by theories about collective action, ideologies of Zionism, which said that the Jews can save themselves by going to Palestine, ideologies of communism, which said that the Jews can save themselves by trusting in the Soviet Union, the ideology of the Jewish Labor Bund, which said that the Jews of Poland could save themselves by fighting for a democratic socialist Poland, but that all of these ideologies stressed the collective, that salvation would somehow come through collective action. But in the process, the needs of the individual were totally ignored. The dynamics of how an individual belonging to an oppressed group would be able to fight back, would be able to survive, would be able to map out some viable strategy that would keep him from going under or succumbing to despair. And so Weinreich was fascinated at a time when collectivist ideologies dominated public discourse. And this was the time of the rise of fascism, the rise of Hitler, the growing allure of communism. During that era, what Weinreich was trying to figure out was, how do you understand that relationship between the individual and the collective? How do you get insights into a culture which sets the ground rules for, on the one hand, individual exploration, individual self-knowledge, and on the other hand, recognizes the impact of a collective phenomena like discrimination on the choices facing the individual. And so in the early 1930s, Weinreich gets a Rockefeller Fellowship, and he goes to Yale. He goes to Yale University, and there he studies with scholars such as Edward Sapir and John Dollard, and he reads Frederick Boas, he reads John Dewey, he reads Robert and Helen Lynn's study of Middletown, and then he decides that during his vacation, that the year that he's at Yale, he's going to go to the South and visit African American colleges like the Tuskegee Institute to find out how the African American community gives their young people in the Jim Crow South, gives their young people the psychological weapons to defend themselves, to make life choices, create an individual identity. And he goes to Fisk, he goes to Tuskegee, and he really makes a deep effort to understand the dynamics of discrimination and how it affects the individual personality. And this leads him to a growing interest in social psychology. After he leaves Yale, he spends some time in Vienna, where he makes the acquaintance of Charlotte Buhler, and he begins to translate Sigmund Freud into Yiddish. He works with Siegfried Bernfeld, and in that intellectual odyssey, he comes up with the idea of studying Jewish youth by encouraging them to write their autobiographies, by encouraging them to write the story of their lives, to hold nothing back, to be honest, to describe what it's like to grow up in a society that regards you as a second-class citizen, to search their memory for the first time that they felt anti-Semitism, to describe their relationship with their parents, to describe their relationship with their siblings, to describe their schooling, their aspirations. And what's remarkable is that in taking this road, to encourage the writing of youth autobiographies as the first step in what Weinreich calls Jugendforschung, the study of Jewish youth, Weinreich is not advocating for any political agenda. He's not advocating for Zionism. He's not advocating for communism. What he's saying is, we live here. We can't escape. We can't seek salvation in half-baked utopian solutions. We have to figure out how we can reshape ourselves psychologically so that we can cope with the difficulties that we face. And he then says that he's collecting information. He doesn't have answers. He's beginning a process. He's beginning an intellectual search. And as part of that search, in 1939, he invited John Dollard to come to Vilna to give a series of lectures, which included the psychological effects of Jim Crow in the American South. And of course, Dollard's first lecture was scheduled for September 1939, and that's when World War II broke out. So those lectures never took place. When the war began, Weinreich was not in Vilna. He was in Copenhagen at a linguistic conference, and that saved his life. He and his son, Yuri, were able to go to the United States, and they were joined a year later by Weinreich's wife and his other son, Gabriel.
Well, the lecture may not have taken place, but it sounded like it lived on in the influence that he brought to Ringelblum in the conceptualization of the archive. Can you share with us your sense of the beginning? And I know it went through various phases as the conditions changed, but can you put us into Emanuel Ringelblum's mind as the walls of the ghetto are being built and he is starting a personal diary and then starting a larger effort, the people he asked to keep records and how he organized it and what your sense of his thinking was?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, let me say right off the bat that there are real differences between Ringelblum and Max Weinreich. Ringelblum was politically committed. He was a member of a left-wing radical Marxist organization. But you might say that Ringelblum was always torn. He was always navigating the tension between his identity as a political radical and his identity as a member of the EVO, as a member of the organization that Weinreich directed. As a political radical, Ringelblum spouted all the ideological slogans about the Soviet Union and about the demise of capitalism and so on. But as a member of the EVO, Ringelblum kind of tried to check his politics at the door, and he bought into Weinreich's approach of interviews, of life writing, of getting ordinary people to talk about their lives, to get young people to describe their fears and their aspirations, to focus on a picture of everyday life in order to give the Jews of Eastern Europe, who were so lacking in power and so lacking the typical weapons that a powerful nation would have, to give these vulnerable people the tools to know themselves, to build up their own institutions, to help themselves, and to instill in their young people hopes for a better future. Now, when the archive began, of course, the archive begins in 1940. The Germans themselves do not decide they're going to murder all the Jews. They don't decide on the final solution until late 1941. So when the archive begins, Ringelblum is creating the archive in order to do what Max Weinreich has been doing with the EVO, that is to get people to write about their lives, to get people to describe their experiences so as to use the knowledge gained to help the psychological and the community rebuilding after the war. The war will be over. We'll rebuild our lives. What lessons will this experience have taught us? The way to get that information is to get people to write essays, to do interviews. Ringelblum and his staff, all of whom had been closely involved in the EVO before the war, Ringelblum and his staff in 1941 decided on a huge study project, which included 80 different topics: women under the German occupation, young people under the German occupation, religious life, corruption, smuggling, self-help. And these 80 topics were each headed by a team leader. So some members of Ringelblum's team were team leaders of four or five topics. Each topic had questionnaires, which were based on the EVO methods worked out before the war, pages and pages of questions about the tiniest details. There was a study project on entitled The Street, what the street in the ghetto looked like, colors, sounds, personal interactions, confrontations between strangers. Topic on Jewish women tried to include interviews with women from different social classes and different educational backgrounds. Ringelblum said that in getting testimonies, he wanted the same event to be described by as many different people as possible, from different standpoints, from different viewpoints. And so he was hoping that all of this would result in a huge work of social psychology, which would help the community find its bearings when the war was over. And then, of course, this was all overtaken by events, because when the project was in full swing and when thousands and thousands of pages were being written and all the interviews were being done and all the questionnaires were being reviewed, in July 1942, the Germans began the deportations to Treblinka. And the fourth day after the beginning of the deportations, Ringelblum ordered everybody in the archive to hand over all their notes, all their questionnaires, all their unfinished materials. He said that if they're found after the war, they should be sent to the YIVO, which by that time had moved to New York.
Sam, let me interrupt you for a second, because not everyone is going to know what the YIVO is, though I hasten to add that Freud was on the board of YIVO. But can you describe a little bit about it and how it played a part both from Weinreich and in Ringelblum's development?
Yeah, the YIVO is the Yiddish Scientific Institute. And it was founded in 1925. It was based in Vilna. And the purpose of the Yiddish Scientific Institute was to study the life, the history, the language, the folklore, the literature, the psychology of the millions and millions of East European Jews who were primarily Yiddish speaking. This was a community of millions of people who lacked their own state, who lacked their own territory, who were a minority people. And what the YIVO did was to organize a group of scholars that would reach out to ordinary people and tell these ordinary people, we need you to work with us in documenting and studying our own lives, not just the past, but the present, in order to build a better future. The YIVO really believed that knowledge would compensate for the lack of political power that the Jews had. Because it was not a formal university, it was extremely interdisciplinary. And Weinreich was the director of the YIVO, and Weinreich's intellectual trajectory was reflected in what happened to the YIVO itself. Weinreich began as a philologist. He got a PhD in linguistics from Marburg University. He wrote works on the history of Yiddish literature, and then in the 1930s, after Yale, he begins to take a deeper and deeper interest in social psychology and then in psychiatry.
Now, the character of the archive changed once the deportation started, yes?
When the deportation started, the Onyx Shabbos archive was rapidly decimated.
Just, this is the first time you use the word Onyx Shabbos. Why don't you just describe that?
Yeah, the Onyx Shabbos archive was the code name that Ringelblum used for this organization. Beginning in 1940, Ringelblum brought together a group that would eventually number 60 people. This was called the Onyx Shabbos Joy of the Sabbath, because its executive committee met on Saturday afternoons. It was important to keep the whole project top secret. And in fact, they managed to keep it secret. It was extremely well organized. There was an executive committee. There were interviewers. There were copiers. There were only five or six people who knew where the documents were at any particular time. And of the 60 or so people that Ringelblum brought together in this project, by the time the war was over, there were only three survivors, and only one knew where the archive was buried. the archive was buried in different
texts. Let me interrupt you. Let's hold that at that piece of the story to the end, because if it was on a TV show, you would say it's too improbable to be true. It's one of these amazing survivor stories. But I learned from your book many things. Cultural resistance. Tell me what that means to you and what it meant to them.
One of the things that Ringelblum realized is that resistance means that you don't just fight with guns. You can fight with pen and paper. If the Germans intend not only to murder you and your people, but then to decide how you will be remembered, then if you try to thwart that goal, even from beyond the grave, you're resisting. One of Ringelblum's teachers, Isaac Schipper, told a fellow inmate at Majdanek just before Schipper was killed, I quote, "What we know about murdered peoples is usually what their killers choose to say about them. The Germans thought they would win the war, they would murder all the Jews, and posterity would learn about the Jews from the perverse propaganda films and posters that the Germans made." And what Ringelblum said is, no, even if we don't live to see it, we will bury time capsules. We will leave evidence concealed that will surface after the war. The world will remember us on the basis of Jewish sources and not on the basis of German sources. Even if we're killed by the Germans, we will be remembered for what we did. Our names will be remembered. We will not just be faceless, anonymous victims. We will not just be reduced to a part of, quote unquote, the 6 million. People will know who we were. People will know what we dreamed of, what we hoped for. People will know how we educated our kids, how we helped each other, how we struggled to maintain our human dignity, even in the face of the worst kind of oppression. And at the same time, we will tell the whole truth. Not everything in the ghetto was noble. In fact, there was a lot of corruption and there was a lot of moral depravity. And we will tell that story too. Because by telling an honest story and by assembling truthful documents, future historians will understand what we went through and what we faced.
And Sam, I must say, I've read your book. It's called Who Will Write Our History? And I'm aware that in the world of Holocaust studies, there are tensions, as there are among historians, like there are among analysts. And there is a school of thought that emphasizes just numbers and documentation, and then there's a school that emphasizes ethnography, that is, people's stories. And what I found so remarkable about this book is that you cover both in such a balanced, beautiful way. One has to bear some of the stories that you share with us, but that is the truth of it. But I do want to mention how highly I respected how you managed to speak to both ways of thinking.
Yeah, it was very important that the story of what came to be called the Holocaust not be told just on the basis of what the perpetrators did, that the history of the Holocaust is not just a history of how the Germans carried out the crime. It's not just a story that rests on German documents, but it's a story that has to bring in the voice of the victims. Even if the victims were killed, the story has to respect the efforts they made to be heard, to leave a trace, to be remembered. And Ringelblum and the people who worked with him believed that what they were doing was so important, not just for Jews, but for all of mankind. One of the members of the archive, a woman, Gustava Yaretska, wrote an essay. It was unfinished. She and her two kids were killed in Treblinka. But in that unfinished essay, among other things, Yaretska said, "These documents that I'm writing, what I'm writing, why am I doing this? Because we were told in school growing up that history, that the story of mankind is a story of progress, that history moves from savagery to barbarism to decency. But now we see, as the Germans are murdering little children in the streets, we see that we had been wrong, that history was moving in the opposite direction, from decency to savagery. And if that is true, then maybe what I'm writing, if someday if people read this and discover this, they will say to themselves, my God, how could we have allowed this to happen? And so what I'm trying to do, she wrote, is to throw a stone under history's wheel, to throw a stone under history's wheel, that maybe my writings will so shock people that they will say to themselves, we will not let this happen again. We will change the course of history. We will move it onto a trajectory of decency and humanity. This is what she believed.
Yeah, I read that line so many times, a stone under history's wheel, meaning that she wanted her words, her experiences, to interrupt the backward flow, the backward movement of history back to barbarism, which said to me that she had inside her what we would call a good object, that is, a sense that there are decent people still. And if decent people learn about this, they will be so distraught, they will work so hard to prevent it from happening, that there is goodness. If only they knew, then circumstance would change. And that speaks well of her and her upbringing, that she had that inside her. Unfortunately, it turned out not to be the case, that it hasn't stopped history, that history is not going in just one direction, as we see daily. It's going in multiple directions. Yes, there is goodness, certainly, in the world, but there is terrible, terrible darkness on a daily basis. So I'm not quite sure how to end that sentence, but I feel for what she was trying to reach out and do.
Well, the members of the archive were overly optimistic in that they believe that when the milk cans that they hid their documents, that when the milk cans would surface after the war, that it would have a huge impact. And that was not the case. There are many reasons for that. I think one important reason is that Jews in Israel, Jews in the United States, they wanted a feel-good story that would help them deal with their present problems. The Israelis wanted a story of heroic resistance. American Jews wanted stories of heroic resistance or sublime martyrdom. But so much of the Onyx Shabbos archive is neither about armed resistance nor about martyrdom. It's about ordinary people trying to live their lives, trying to cope, ordinary people trying to understand what's happening to them. It's a story of soup kitchens. It's a story of refugee centers. It's a story of people trying to save their skins at the expense of others. It's a story that chronicles anger and betrayal. It's a story that examines how people react to the fear of death, to danger. And those reactions don't always bring out the best. So the story was such that while it painted a important picture of Jewish life under the German occupation, it was not convenient for those who wanted something more useful when the war was over. The members of the archive were very much interested in not so much in the leaders, either the leaders of the Jewish Council or the leaders of the fighting organizations. They were not so much interested in the famous personalities of the ghetto. Mm-hmm. They were interested in the everyday. They were interested in ordinary people. And that story proved to be less compelling after the war than they would have hoped. Now, in the last 10 years or so, historians are taking another look. Historians are discovering the treasure trove of information, of insights that the archive contains. They're fascinated by these stories of individual lives. They're digging them up. They're writing about them. But it took decades and decades for that to happen.
Let's talk about the hiding of and the discovery, including Hirschwasser's amazing journey to discovery, survival and discovery.
Yeah, Hirsch, as I said, of the 60 or so people who Ringelblum brought together into the archive project, there were only three survivors. And Hirschwasser, who was one of the two executive secretaries of the archive, Hirschwasser was the only survivor who really knew where the milk cans were buried. And he survived by like all survivors, he survived by miracles. Once jumping from a train that was on its way to Treblinka during the big Polish uprising of 1944, he was in a bunker with five other Jews, and the Germans threw grenades into the bunker. And again, he and his wife survived, and the other Jews were killed. When the war was over, he, his wife, and Rachel Auerbach, the third survivor, they pleaded, they cajoled, they begged different authorities to start a search. Warsaw was a sea of rubble. It was like undertaking an archaeological expedition. Now, Wasser said, we buried the milk cans and the tin cans under Novolipki 68, the site of what had been a Jewish school in the ghetto. But Warsaw had been so leveled by the Jewish uprising of 43 and then the Polish uprising of 44 that you didn't even know where a street had been. But they finally figured out where in the rubble that building must have been, and they dug. And in September 46, they found 10 tin boxes, which was the first cache buried in August 42. And Wasser said, we buried a lot more, but they couldn't find anything else. And then Poland became Stalinist and communist. The survivors, Wasser, his wife, Auerbach, went to Israel. And then in December 1950, Polish construction workers came across two aluminum milk cans, and this was the second cache, which had been buried in February 1943. And Wasser said they'd buried a third cache on Świętejerska 34, which over time became the site of the Chinese embassy, but nothing was ever found there.
But with the second cache, the story that you write about is that some workmen were digging and they hit upon it and they were about to toss it. Why don't you tell that story?
Well, yeah, I mean, there was, after the war, all over Eastern Europe, non-Jews dug in ghettos. They dug in the former death camps because, quote unquote, all the Jews had gold. All the Jews were rich. And it was like a gold rush. They were hoping to find hidden treasure. And when they came across those milk cans, they thought that there was a buried gold and diamonds. And when they found the papers, they were just going to junk them. But then a foreman came back and said, no, we can't junk these. We have to take these to the Jewish Historical Institute. And that's how Ringelblum's diary survived. That's how Abraham Lewin's diary survived. That's how so many priceless materials were rescued because a foreman came back from lunch.
Yeah, isn't that something? Unfortunately, Emanuel Ringelblum did not survive. And why don't you share that story as well?
Yeah, Ringelblum was caught by the Germans the fourth day of the Battle of the Warsaw Ghetto in April 1943, and he was sent to the Travniki labor camp. And a daring rescue mission got him out of that camp in August 1943, and he went into a hideout in the south part of Warsaw that contained 36 other Jews, including his wife and his son, Yuri. This hideout was built under a greenhouse maintained by a Polish family. And the conditions there were very, very tough. It was overcrowded. It was dark. The air was totally stifling. There were two people who left the hideout, survived the war, and one of the people wrote memoirs of how in the darkness and in this fear that you could cut with a knife, Ringelblum sat in a corner of the hideout and just wrote constantly by the light of a carbide lamp. And he literally wrote thousands of pages. He wrote essays about Jewish writers and poets who were killed. He wrote about the Jewish resistance. He also wrote a masterpiece called Polish-Jewish Relations in the Second World War. Now, usually when you write a really good book, you have Xerox machines and graduate assistants and libraries. He wrote this in a hideout. It was translated into English in 1992 and published by Northwestern University Press. He had a chance to leave that hideout and go to a safer place, but his wife was so traumatized that she didn't want to leave. So they stayed and stayed. And meanwhile, one of the Poles, who was risking his life, of course, to keep the hideout going, but he was getting a lot of money and he was beginning to live large. And he was attracting attention, and he apparently began to have an affair, which, of course, angered his wife. And one thing led to another, and an informer led the Gestapo to the hideout on March 7th, 1944. Actually, it was a special unit of Polish police that specialized in finding Jews in hiding, and they would share the loot with the Germans. So they were discovered on March 7th, 1944. They were taken to the Pawiak prison. There was a journalist who was in the prison who survived the war and said that when some of the prisoners heard that Ringelblum was there, they tried to save him by bribing guards to get him out of that cell and get him into another cell. But when this journalist, Yechiel Hirschaut, went to talk to Ringelblum, he saw Ringelblum had been tortured. He'd been badly beaten. His son was sitting on his lap. The journalist outlined this scheme to kind of spirit him into another cell. Ringelblum asked about his son, about his wife. The journalist shook his head. We could only save you. Ringelblum said, no, I'll die with them. And then he said in Yiddish, why, pointing to his son. Why is my boy going to die? What did he do? This, my heart is breaking when I look at my little boy. And the next day, all of the Jews and two of the Poles who were involved in this hideout were shot right in front of the prison in the ruins of the former Warsaw Ghetto. So Ringelblum was shot on March 10th, 1944. Now, just a week before he was caught, he and a friend, Adolf Berman, wrote a long letter to the YIVO in New York. And that letter reached New York a few months later. It was spirited out by the Polish underground. And Ringelblum talked about the cultural resistance, the spiritual resistance, the schools, the theaters, the archive. And he said that culture was a major weapon in our attempt to maintain our human spirit, even in the face of such terrible oppression. And he finished that letter on March 1st, 1944, so just a week before he was killed.
Thank you for that, Sam. Let me shift gears. I mean, we can continue this conversation at great length. There's a sentence in your book from the introduction. You write, "Ringelblum, the historian, did not give up his hope that historians still had something to tell a post-war world, to teach lessons that would prevent another genocide." Sam, it seems to me that the title of your book, "Who Will Write Our History," is at least in part answered that you will write our history. But for your labor of love, your life's work, we wouldn't be having this conversation, and your book translated into 8 languages, and the lectures you've given all over the world, no one would know of this, which is something. Can you tell us about you and what has brought you to this?
Yeah, well, I started out, as a historian, I started out as a Russian historian of Tsarist Russia. I was born in Germany after the war. My parents were Holocaust survivors. My mother especially had a very, very hard time. I grew up in a community of survivors, and it was such a difficult childhood. And I remember many visits to the Child Study Center at Yale University. This was in New Haven, Connecticut. It was such a difficult childhood that when I grew up and became an adult and decided I'd be a historian, I said, the one thing I'm not going to do is study the Holocaust. I'm going to get away from it. And I studied Russian history. I spent 13 months at Leningrad University in the 70s, and then I went back to Moscow University a few years later, and I spent a long time immersing myself in Russian history and Russian culture. But after my parents died, something pulled me back. I understood that we had to tell their story, that especially in the United States and in Europe, not so much in Israel, but in the United States and in Europe, even as historians were writing about the Holocaust, it was mainly about the perpetrators. And the voice of the Jewish victims did not figure into the story. And so because I knew Yiddish and because I could read all the languages that I needed, I decided that I would start to tell that story. And one thing led to another, and that led me to the Ringelblum Archive.
And what do you hope going forward will come from your work and, I presume, ongoing work researching the archive? Because I know much of it has been translated, but not all of it. Is that correct?
Well, now in Poland, the Jewish Historical Institute has just finished a translation of the entire readable part of the archive, because a lot of documents were ruined by water seepage and so on. So 36 volumes have been published in Polish, with CD-ROMs at the back of each volume with the original documents. About 50% of the original documents were in Polish, 45% were in Yiddish, 5% in other languages. But what I hope is that the story of the archive, along with other histories, will simply do what Gustave Yaretzka hoped it would do, that is, throw a stone under history's wheel. Am I terribly optimistic? No. But it's something that's worth thinking about and something that deserves a lot of respect.
It certainly is. Sam, I want to express my gratitude to you. This all began for me on a tour of the Warsaw Ghetto, and I don't know where it's going to end, but there's something vital in, obviously, the archive. There's something vital in how respectfully you've studied it and presented it in a very readable, living, terribly painful, but important way for non-historians to read it. At least one of my reactions when I learned of it, which was that, gee, no one seems to have heard of it. Maybe you and I tonight made a little dent in that. Again, your book is called Who Will Write Our History? Sam, I'm grateful for your work and for spending time with me. Thank you.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.